Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva. Well, fascination with the Viking Age seems to be at an all-time high, though of course it has never really gone out of fashion. There is something irresistibly compelling about this civilization dedicated to boldly exploring the horizons of the known world, forging an empire that stretched from North America to Kiev, and dominating the political and economic landscape from the fall of Rome to the First Crusade. Writers, artists, and musicians have found inspiration in the sagas of the Vikings, and modern culture, too, has mined the canon for inspirations for such blockbusters as Game of Thrones and the Marvel films. But few scholars have delved into the world of Viking women until now. My guest today is Johanna Katrin Friedrichsdatter, a distinguished academic currently based at the National Library of Norway in Oslo after teaching at Yale University. Her new book, Valkyrie, Women of the Viking World, is a deeply satisfying exploration of the lives of Viking women. The book is skillfully arranged around the skeleton life cycle of a woman from birth through childhood, adolescence, marriage, and then finally old age. But Johanna has expertly fleshed this skeleton out with examples drawn from archaeology, contemporary accounts, and the rich literary vein of the Old Norse sagas. The result is a truly compelling read that helps us better understand the women behind the great men of the Viking Age, who emerge as powerful agents for change in their own right. I'm so delighted that the book brings Johanna Katrin Friedrichsdatter to the New Books Network today. Johanna, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. That was a great intro.
Well, it's a great book, and I'd like to start with the book itself and the title. Could you tell us what exactly a Valkyrie is and what we know about them? Because I think there is, in modern culture, a lot of sort of sexy Valkyrie images. There certainly are on Pinterest. But what exactly is it, a Valkyrie?
Valkyries, yeah. I mean, they are so fascinating, and it's true that they have this kind of sexy image, maybe, which isn't necessarily what the Vikings themselves believed. At the heart of things, a Valkyrie is a woman who is supernatural, and she comes to battles and she chooses the slain. That's the etymology of the word. So she decides who dies and who lives on the battlefield. And the warriors who die, they get to go to Odin, or Freya, probably. And this female creature is the one who kind of takes them there. They aren't necessarily very sexy. They are kind of bloodthirsty, and they're really excited about, you know, picking who dies and so on. So it's maybe a little bit later that they kind of become like sort of companions and romantic interests in some Viking culture. But originally they just seem to be like, you know, sort of very scary and alarming. And mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I take a loop back to something you've just said, which is you say that the Valkyries choose whether to take the slain to Odin or Freya. Is there a difference between those two? Who are Odin and Freya?
Oh, sorry. Yes.
No, it's okay.
So Odin is the god of war in Norse mythology, and he's supposed to be the sort of highest god, the most important one. And then Freya is one of many other gods, and she is said to have half of the slain. And then Odin gets the other half, and they are sort of the reason why they are collecting these dead warriors is that there's going to be an event in the future, sort of in the timeline of Norse mythology. It's in the future for them, where it's called Ragnarok. You might have heard of it. It's sort of like the apocalypse in some ways, because it's this sort of ultimate battle between evil forces or hostile forces and the gods. And so they need this army of dead warriors in order to fight them. And then most of them die in this battle, but a couple of them actually survive and then build a new world.
Oh, goodness me.
Very exciting.
I see. So so the Valkyries are supernatural beings. They're not real women, but you've chosen to focus on the lives of real women. And I love the structure of the book. You take a woman from birth to death. How did you go about choosing that particular structure?
Well, thank you. I don't want to take all credit for it, because it was actually my friend and former supervisor, Caroline Larrington, who suggested it when I was just standing in her kitchen saying, oh, I think I'm going to write this book. And she said, yeah, you should structure it along the life cycle. And I just went, yeah. So it was.
Well, it seems a very organic structure, and it makes for a very compelling read, because you're kind of following a woman, many women, through their lives.
It just worked so well. And I just committed to it immediately, and everything kind of just fell into place after that. And it sort of makes a lot of sense, because when we say Viking women, you know, that is quite a big term. And I kind of wanted to try to nuance it quite a lot. And so, you know, your life wasn't the same when you were a widow as when you were a teenage girl, and or a married woman, mm-hmm. or an old woman. And so kind of trying to bring that out, you know, with that structure, that really enabled me to go into those nuances.
And what was your process? I mean, there Viking studies is frustrating but exciting, because there aren't as many sources as there are for, say, Renaissance Europe. What can a scholar delve into to look for data?
Yeah, the data is, I mean, if you're a Viking scholar, you kind of have to be a jack of all trades in some way, because you have to learn how to deal with sources that are so disparate, and so, you know, graves and texts that are maybe written, you know, contemporary, but from, you know, someone who's biased against Vikings, or texts that are written several hundred years after the events that they describe. And then there are rune stones. So they, the Vikings themselves, sorry.
No worries.
So the Vikings themselves, they put up these stones kind of usually at like crossroads or somewhere in the outdoors, but where people would be passing by. And they had, they had someone carve inscriptions in runes on these stones. And so, you know, you're sort of dealing with so many different sources, and you have to be able to sort of synthesize them in a way that makes sense and is useful.
And I would say that the strongest threads in the book are the sagas, because you delve into those really compelling stories to give examples of women at different stages and different sort of crises in their lives. And of course the sagas is a huge canon of really fascinating literature, and you're obviously very familiar with each and every story. Because our time is limited, I wondered if you might tell us the story of one woman who appears throughout your book, and that's Gudrun, who's a super complicated character, and her story is not a fairy tale. at all. But I think that she goes through many of the challenges that you highlight in the book. So I wondered if you might just share with the listeners an outline of Gudrun's story.
Yes. So Gudrun is a legendary heroine, and she appears in several different texts, and the kind of Saga of the Volsungs is maybe the most accessible one if you are looking to read about her. And then she also appears in some poems called Eddic poems. And she belongs to a dynasty of these legendary figures. And she has several brothers who are all great heroes. And then one day, this fabulous man turns up at the court, and he is Sigurd the Dragon Slayer, and he's the same character as Siegfried in the Nibelungen Lied and the operas by Wagner. If you're an opera fan,
I am.
Yes.
Not necessarily Wagner, but
no. But a lot of people really like the Ring Cycle, and you know, they're familiar with these characters from there. And so she's called Kriemhild in the German version. But at any rate, she kind of just grows up like a princess, and she's very sort of vulnerable and kind of innocent in the beginning, and then everyone starts killing each other, basically. So her Sigurd, when he kills the dragon, he gets the dragon's treasure. And then her brothers and her mother are extremely jealous of this treasure, and they really want it. So they kind of start figuring out a plan how to get it. And they eventually have Sigurd killed. And then there's this kind of other woman who's mixed up into this. So there's kind of love and jealousy and betrayal, and there's a conflict between the brothers and the sister and so on. Mm-hmm. And so she's kind of stuck between loyalties, and it's a story that seems to have been extremely popular among the Norse, and the sort of, if there was ever any kind of event that this is modeled on, that would have been like so far in the past that like whatever happened had changed so much by the time they started writing it down. But they're clearly extremely compelled by all of these kind of betrayals and like the situation that Gudrun finds herself in. And then she gets sort of bullied into a second marriage to a husband who then kills her brother. And she, she goes from this extremely innocent young woman to someone who actually kills her own children in order to avenge herself on her husband who had killed her brothers. And so she kills her own children and then cooks them and feeds them to him. And it's just all so kind of abjectly horrible. I really doubt that this was like, anything that was real for most people, but they're interested in talking about like what happens if you're so kind of hell-bent on revenge and you can't sort of let things go. And and there's something about the sort of the mother, like, almost sort of shirking that kind of maternal.
Doing the unthinkable.
Yeah, exactly. And how far is one willing to go in order to exact revenge? And so she is this kind of figure. People are kind of engaging with all kinds of different themes and anxieties through telling her story. And she's just completely fascinating.
And from Gudrun's story and some of the other sagas, and your book, I get the sense that Viking women were far less sort of shut up or cloistered away than their European counterparts were during the same period. Is this like an age of opportunity as far as Viking women are concerned, or what is their ability to get out of the house or out of the kitchen?
Yeah, I think in many ways, because the men are going away and they're away for, you know, very long stretches of time, and they sometimes don't even come back. And it's sort of a boom time in the economy. And so compared to like before and after, there's just, there's a lot of opportunities to kind of increase your family's income. And there's, the goods are flowing around. And so you can, if you have anything to sell, you can kind of get into the markets and get a much better price. And there's just much, much more demand, for example, for textiles. So when the Vikings are going off on their raiding and trading and everything, they needed sales. And so if you were, a sort of enterprising, resourceful woman, you could probably, try to maybe get set up as a business and spin and weave and make sales. Or if you had access to some sort of raw material that was desirable, you could try to start harvesting that and selling it. So there's just, the economy is much sort of more active than maybe in the previous era. And so even if you're like living at home and you never really leave your sort of home region, it's still like a time when everything is just flowing around and there's people are moving around more and so on. And so, that's one thing. But then also the women were sort of going with the men sometimes on expeditions and then to colonize and settle.
So, and they would go, and you say that they would go for a long time, and there's this concept of overwintering, I think, where you go to some place where presumably the weather is better.
What do you mean?
I don't mean to demean the Norwegian weather. But
well,
is that the case?
They actually travel quite like surprisingly much. I think that that's one of the things that might actually surprise you when you start reading sagas is that, but they are definitely sort of going off on the Viking trips, often just for the summer, and then coming back and staying at home for the winter. But it's sort of, you'd be surprised at like where people actually lived and went, like even in the middle of the winter. So they seem to have had no concept of bad weather, just bad clothes, maybe.
Right, just bad clothes. And because women are more out in the world, they do put themselves in harm's way more. And one horrific example is sort of myth as well as story is the story of Rinda, who was raped by the god Odin. And I saw that in your book as sort of a reflection of the Viking attitude towards rape, which kind of crops up often, it seems to me. How did the Vikings treat this idea of sort of sexual assault?
Yeah, I mean, there's no one answer because I think people probably disagreed about the level of male entitlement to women's bodies. And I mean, just the fact that women are sort of like female characters are expressing kind of fear of getting raped and so on means that there must have been some kind of pushback against the idea that like women were just sort of there to be taken by men. And it's different as well. Like, I mean, because the Vikings were patriarchal, there's one myth about them that they sort of practiced free love or something like that. And that's just a complete misunderstanding, I think. And it was very dishonorable for you, if you were a father or a husband, if other men could sort of get close to your women. And whether the woman was consenting or not, I mean, it was very dishonorable. And so, I mean, there's this myth about Rindr and her rape by Odin is kind of referred to in several different sources in Old Norse. And there's often it's kind of just like, oh yeah, and she gave birth to this amazing hero who had a very important job at Ragnarök. And it's sort of like almost like she's supposed to be, you know, we're supposed to be happy for her or something like that. that this you know, sexual encounter it resulted in that. But then there's a really sort of long and full version of the myth that is related in a source in Latin, actually, that was written by Saxo Grammaticus, who was this monk sitting in Denmark, and he wrote the myth, and he kind of, it's really interesting how he's very ambivalent, because the sort of generally the sources often sort of encourage the reader to align themselves with, you know, the sort of dominant attitude, and which is often male. And Saxo is kind of telling the story about her getting raped, and he's just like not really able to present it as completely like normal, and you know, that she should be grateful or something, that that she gets to give birth to this great hero. And so, yeah.
This, but he's a Christian monk.
Exactly. Yeah.
And like some of his other sort of chroniclers, like Snorri Sturluson, Adam of Bremen, they are writing at least three centuries. Is that right? 3 centuries after sort of the height of the Viking Age.
Yeah, like 200 and something years after. Yeah, Snorri.
Right.
Saxo.
What about the sort of Norse mythology itself? I mean, what does that have to tell us about sexual infidelity? And it seems to me in a way that there was kind of a double standard.
Yeah, I mean, I think it to an extent that's absolutely correct. And, you know, the sort of mistresses get referred to as just kind of normal, at least if you are a king or, you know, somebody important and somebody with high social status. And there's like in Heimskringla, which is a long sort of saga about Norwegian kings. The kings often kind of are extremely promiscuous, and they travel around usually, and they sort of just go and stay with someone like the local chieftain or something, and then they just sort of shack up with, you know, their daughter for a while. And usually the chieftain is like thrilled because he'll benefit usually from this, and so the woman's feelings in the matter are usually not considered at all in those sorts of stories. And, you know, if she ends up having a son, then that son could have a claim on the throne. So it's sort of like very transactional, really. And so, you know, in those cases, it seems that there's not a lot of worry about, like, whether or not they were married or, you know, it's not really like a moral question. Mm-hmm. But when, you know, you get to Iceland and it's sort of just like farmers, you know, if there's a local farmer and there's someone is kind of trying to seduce his daughter and he's not really able to resist that, that can really be a terrible loss of honor as well. But but then you also have like women cheating on their husbands and sort of just openly defying them. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, again, like it doesn't seem to be necessarily because, you know, they lack complete, you know, sorry.
It doesn't
necessarily seem to be that they are, you know, immoral or something. And that's not really what the sources are sort of worried about. It's much more that the couple doesn't seem to be suited.
Which begs the question, you spend a lot of time on in your book about how do women get married and what is the recipe for a happy Viking marriage? And I wonder if you could expand on that. What were the qualities that a Viking man would look for in a potential wife?
Yeah, that's probably varied from one individual to another in some ways. When a marriage is contracted, it's usually arranged. And so, you know, like in very many patriarchal conservative societies, the woman, or usually a teenage girl, she's just kind of told, like, oh, you're going to marry so-and-so. And then she's not told until after it's been arranged. And a man would have probably been looking mostly for a woman who had, you know, a family that was sort of, you know, useful to have on your side. Mm-hmm. Sometimes men who have become rich, you know, for example, through trade or something, they actually kind of want to marry up socially to somebody who's got more social status. And that usually doesn't go very well. And if the woman kind of thinks that she's been married beneath her, she isn't very happy, and she openly just flaunts sort of her unhappiness sometimes in the sagas. Mm-hmm. And she'll, like, there's sort of stories about them just spending all the money and not consulting the husband and kind of just being really, you know, unpleasant sometimes. And yeah, like having affairs and so on. So, I mean, I would say the recipe for a good marriage is usually that that the couple is well suited to each other, they're social equals, and have the sort of same values and attitudes, just like in probably most successful marriages. And then, absolutely, you know, yeah. Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that the woman, you know, for the family, for their economy and sort of their life to be prosperous, she would have needed to be, you know, assertive and hardworking and resourceful, and sort of no nonsense. And what I really like about the sagas is that they often show women sort of being their husband's friends and advisors, and they just talk everything through. And the woman sometimes tells the husband, like, you know, this is a bad plan, I don't think you should do this. And then he kind of backs off and everything goes well. And so they get a lot of respect.
And throughout your book, there seems to be a sense that women are the repository of sort of secret knowledge often in the sagas, that they know not magic, but sort of the otherworldly aspects of things.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of blurring with the mythology sometimes, and the saga authors are kind of maybe a little mystified and almost scared of women, and they sort of feel that they have access to knowledge that men don't necessarily have, and that's sort of there are all kinds of women who are called, you know, they know many things. So if a saga introduces a woman with something like that, then you know that she's, you know, she's maybe able to do magic, but you're not quite sure. And so there's a lot of sort of they sort of allude to things without necessarily being very explicit. But sometimes that kind of character blurs into a sort of more of a prophetess type. Mm-hmm. Who's able to see the future and kind of make good prophecies or bad prophecies, and bring sort of, you know, you can use that as a saga author to create, you know, an atmosphere of doom or, yeah.
But what about real life women, Viking women, who did kind of, you have a wonderful phrase in the book, you say something like the breaking the glass ceiling for the Viking age was difficult, it required a lot of guts, but there was an opportunity for women who were talented to sort of make their way. How did women sort of, if the men were always away, did they rise to positions of political prominence ever?
I think some of them probably did. There's a few characters in the sagas, like in Heimskringla, women who kind of seem to co-rule and with either husbands or sons. And they, you know, they are successful for a period, but then, you know, sometimes alliances break or people lose battles or something. And so they aren't necessarily sort of, you know, successful in the long run, but they might rule for a period. And the most prominent of these is Gunhild, the so-called mother of kings. And she's married to someone who has a fabulous nickname, Eric Bloodaxe.
Excellent.
and they sort of reign in Norway for a bit, and then they get expelled from Norway. And then they go around, you know, these people were so mobile, and so they go to Orkney, I think, and then end up in York. And that's when the Vikings were really sort of coming into their own in England and started to dominate, you know, really big parts of England for, you know, a couple of hundred years or so. She is somebody who the saga authors are just completely fascinated with. And there are all kinds of scenes where she's maybe having, you know, an argument in front of the entire court with her husband, or after his death, she goes back to Norway with her sons. And then she's taking all kinds of lovers. And she's sort of, I can't remember if I called her the Viking cougar or something like that. But she's, you know, she's extremely beautiful and alluring, and she's, you know, definitely having lots of sex with men, you know, half her age. And and there's, I mean, it's really interesting that there's not a huge amount of stigma always in like some of these stories about her. But yeah, like these saga authors are completely fascinated with a woman who knows what she wants.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, and that brings us very skillfully around to a character that many of our listeners may have been maybe familiar with through the TV series Vikings. And I bring this up only because you are delightfully happy to reference all of this modern culture stuff in your book. You often refer to one of my favorite characters from Game of Thrones, Yara Greyjoy, completely tough cookie. But I'm referring, of course, to the marvelous Lagertha from Vikings. And because she is very much a woman who, from the beginning, is her own person. But she is presented as like a shield maiden. And I wonder if you could talk to us about the idea of a shield maiden. It's not the same as a Valkyrie. But what is a shield maiden, and to what extent are they fact or fiction?
Yes. How much time do we have?
Oh, we have enough time.
Yeah.
We'll make time.
It's a really fascinating subject, and there's a lot to talk about. And there's this kind of continuum in the Norse sources themselves, from maybe the Valkyries, who are actually not fighting per se, but they're there on the battlefield or next to it or something, and they're, you know, very much just like associated with battle. But then in some of these Icelandic sagas, we find shield maidens, and they actually fight, and they sort of seem to have all of the gear and everything that you need for that, and the ships and so on. And then there's this sort of continuum to, like, there's a couple of women who, you know, at one point or another, they are in some kind of peril, and they just take a weapon and use it. But the Shield Maiden, it's a really interesting figure because they mostly operate in this legendary mythical world where they sort of sail around and everything is very exciting and glamorous, but it's not very realistic. It's a little bit like Game of Thrones because they, it's the sort of sagas where there are dragons and dwarves and all kinds of sort of mythical happenings, and you might get Odin popping up. And so it's like, it's kind of hard to use them as sources for anything that would have happened historically. Mm-hmm. But they're great stories, and especially my favorite is Hervor saga, and there's this woman called Hervor who is an only child, and she says to her mother, you know, when she's sort of a teenager, that she wants the mother to give her the same kind of treatment that she would give to a son. And so the mother says okay and gives her a ship and weapons and the, you know, sort of band of Viking followers, and then she just goes off and she's a Viking for a while, and she has a male name, and the saga always refers to this person as a he. And so the saga uses the male pronouns when she's a Viking, and so it's sort of, you wonder whether, like, there just wasn't such a thing as, like, a female warrior. So they have to kind of make her into a male somehow, or, mm-hmm. You also wonder whether this is some kind of way of talking about gender dysphoria, and, you know, which is something that undoubtedly has always existed in every human society. But yeah, as I say, like, these sources are not very good to use as, like, historical, if you want to sort of talk about, like, did, you know, Viking shield maidens exist in reality? But there are, like, Anglo-Saxon sources, for example, where they are actually written by, you know, the people who experienced the Vikings coming and invading their country. And it's the same with, there's a monk in Paris who wrote an account of the siege of Paris in the 9th century. And they kind of say that the Vikings were bringing women with them. And but they sort of kind of make it quite clear that the women were not fighting. And I really like the Parisian monk who kind of mentions at one point that the women are sort of egging on the men and berating them and, like, saying, you're not, you know, fighting well enough and, you know, come on.
This is probably why they bring them.
Yeah.
So that they will, you know,
exactly.
Spurn them on. Because you make the point in the book quite often that goading, that women are very, very useful for sort of goading a hero into action.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, there's just nothing more humiliating than a woman goading you, I think, for a Viking. There's this sort of, that's the other side of the coin when you talk about, like, women as advisors and sort of friends and so on, mm-hmm. where they also need to kind of push and give the men a little bit of a push.
Right. And what happened when a woman, a Viking woman, wants to divorce a Viking man, which from your book, I understand, was something that did happen, if rarely.
Yeah. I mean, it probably didn't happen a lot. And, I mean, you would have needed some witnesses and you needed to go through some legal proceedings. I think the main question was, you know, did you have some other option? Did you have a way out? And so I kind of say that, like, even if the laws that we have that are, you know, probably somewhat representative of the Laws of the Vikings, even though they're written down a little later. And they sort of talk about the need for witnesses, and you need to kind of have a basis. So if the marriage hasn't been kind of consummated, if your spouse is neglecting you and so on, you kind of have to be able to prove it. But I also made the point that some of the sagas sort of show that it's not that simple. And so even if you're in a marriage where some of these conditions are occurring, if no one is willing to support you in this, then you don't really have a way out. So it's not really a de facto, you know, option. Mm-hmm. And I took this example of a woman who is married to this man who wants to make an alliance with her brother. And he has a lot of money. And so he essentially like buys her. And she thinks that she's been married beneath her, and she's really unhappy in this marriage. But, you know, the brother doesn't want them to divorce. And then she starts cheating. And so she cheats on the husband with this former flame. And but the man she cheats with never offers her marriage. And so she's kind of just still stuck. And then he kind of just disappears again. And she's still in the marriage. And so, like, because she doesn't have a way out, she doesn't have a way to support herself or, like, a place to go or anything. So, like, for her, and, like, divorce is, like, not really an option, realistically.
And this seems to crop up again and again. I think it's a reality of the Viking life that leaving is always an option. Like just getting in a ship and sailing away to Iceland, to Greenland, to Kiev is just always, you know, and it's always plan B, if not plan A.
Yeah. I mean, for example, in Eirik's saga and a couple of other sagas, we learn about Eid or Un, she's called, and she has like a different, slightly different name in different sources. And she lives in Caithness for a while, which is in northern Scotland. And her family is kind of very much involved in all these power struggles that are happening in that region, and they lose. And so she kind of realizes that she needs to get the hell out of there. And there's one saga that says that she had like a ship built, and she got away with so much chattels and such a big following that no one else has ever managed to do this, and that just shows how, you know, impressive and amazing this woman was. But that's like definitely not something that just anybody could do. And it's sort of singled out as a big achievement, really. And, you know, in order to have access to a ship and a sail and everything, you needed to have pretty high social status and you know, money and so on.
It's interesting that you say a ship and a sail, because the sail was almost more valuable than the ship, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of difficult to put an exact figure on it, but I was so blown away when I started reading about sails, and it was kind of like, it surprised me that it was not as well known as like how, I mean, I guess when you go to, for example, the Viking Ship Museum in Oslo, you see this beautiful ship. And everything is so, you know, ornate, and it's beautifully carved, and you just kind of have this instant connection with the past, and you know, you can sort of appreciate the skill and the craftsmanship, and you know, you just immediately see like what this must have taken so much work, you know, all the labor, all the skill, and like all of the wood, and just having to process the wood and then carve it, and you know, you can see, you know, this would have taken many people, you know, a lot of time to make. But when you sort of think about sails, you just think, oh well, it's just like a piece of cloth, right?
Like they hoisted the sail and they were away.
Yeah, exactly. and you know, I had absolutely never thought about sails, I will admit. And you know, most people probably don't think that it's a very sexy subject. I mean, you know, compared to the beautiful objects that you can see. and museums.
But the sales took, what, like a whole season to make? And the it was the women who made them.
Yeah, so when I started reading about this, it just dawned on me that, for one woman to make a sale, that would have taken 4 to 5 years. And
golly.
Yes, I know. And so you needed like several hundred sheep in order to have enough wool for the sale. And then you needed to kind of be able to process the wool and comb it and then spin it. And, you know, like spinning is really hard and it takes a lot of skill, and it's really hard on the fingers. If you do it for a while, it's fine. But like to do it, you know, maybe 8 hours a day, every day of the week or almost every day, that would have just been so hard on the body. Mm-hmm. And then just setting up like a loom, it's so much delicate work. And I saw a video of it on YouTube, and it's just like absolutely painstaking and it takes forever. And then you finally get to the point where you can start weaving, and, you know, and then you're just weaving and weaving and it takes forever. And so by the time you have enough fabric for a sale, and then, you know, it's not kind of difficult to see that it would have taken maybe, like a whole winter, you know, if you had 10 people and you're just paying 10 people to work, you know, full time on your sale. And so, yeah, it's sort of, if you do the math, you can see that the ship was just as expensive as the sale, or the other way around.
And this is why the sails are often striped, isn't it? Because the loom is only so wide.
Yeah, it's maybe like a yard wide or so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a Norwegian friend in when we lived in Moscow, and she had an old-fashioned loom, and it was amazing. It's incredibly intricate, and it's actually physically very challenging to work a loom, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're sort of having to bend up and down and
right. Yeah. Well, she made it look very beautiful. It was like a dance, but I could see that, you know, doing it for hours on end would have been really not as romantic.
Yeah.
But so as the Viking Age sort of comes to an end, and Christianity comes in, I mean, this is a subject that I think is for, you know, whole books, but Christianity comes to the Vikings in so many different ways. Mm. But it's almost like lots of threads coming together again with the weaving. Can you sort of unpack for us what role women had to play in the eventual conversion of Christianity? Or is that way too broad a question? I don't know.
No, I mean, you know, I can try a little bit to talk about, you know, what kind of sources we have. And one source that we have from the actual Viking Age is the runestones. And again, as I say, the runestones were sort of usually raised in memory of someone. And so the inscription will say, this is raised in the memory of my father or brother or daughter. And I paid for this and my name is X. and then sometimes there were these kind of prayers, or there was something about the Virgin Mary, and the runestones that were mostly associated with Mary were usually raised by women. And so the scholars who study these runestones, they sort of argue that women were quite like eager to sort of switch from paganism to Mary and Jesus and the Christian religion. And the sort of Icelandic sagas, which are obviously much later and they can't be interpreted quite as sort of reliably in terms of like who actually, you know, it's sort of difficult to generalize that women were more eager to accept Christianity, but that is sort of my overall impression, even though there's like one Viking poet who says that he went to this one area in Sweden and all the women were extremely reluctant to convert. So I think it was like kind of might have been a bit of a culture war. And and it probably, you know, varied from region and just communities and people. And some communities are just always going to be more conservative or more interested in new things. But like, you know, in general, I mean, people, the kings wanted people to convert. So they were extremely, you know, eager for that. And like sometimes quite
so it was,
violently.
It was top down rather than grassroots up.
For the most part. I mean, I think, you know, most people were just kind of getting along with their lives and weren't like necessarily thinking about converting or religion that much. I mean, it's sort of difficult to tell like how fervently religious people were really. And that would have just varied between individuals. But yeah, the kings were very much sort of driving conversion.
Interesting.
And they sort of, I mean, they wanted to quote, modernize their countries because they were sort of modeling themselves on kings further south. So, you know, they, and I mean, in like England and France and so on, nobody wanted to do business with pagans. So yeah, it was sort of like, you know, you just had to be Christian to be able to do business further south.
Well, the Vikings were nothing if not adaptable.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
pretty pragmatic.
Can I ask you this? In Scandinavia, do young women sort of look to the Vikings for as sort of role models or inspiration, or do they? Is it looked upon like in America we look at the pioneer women as sort of examples of hardy bravery? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent. There's a sort of, you know, you might call someone a Valkyrie when you're, you know, praising someone, a young woman maybe, for being assertive. And I mean, I think I'm not really sure to, I don't think that, but Scandinavians really think very much about their Viking roots or Norse roots sort of on an everyday basis, but reenactment is apparently something that's like really kind of growing as a hobby or a lifestyle. And I think with reenactors, there's like different aspects of the Viking Age appeal to different people. And so there are women who are really into, you know, the warrior side of things, and they participate in, you know, recreating battles and like Viking fighting is a sport in Denmark and other countries. But then, you know, there are other women who like to do, you know, the textile work and sort of, I think maybe, you know, just getting away from modern technology and having a different lifestyle, you know, go and do that in a Viking camp for 2 weeks is something that
nice.
Yeah. So I think just different people can kind of take different things away from this. And I've heard of like women who go to these Viking festivals and they, you know, they're a little bit like sort of gypsy, what do they call, like sort of fortune tellers, except
fun.
Yes, but they're basing themselves on the prophetesses and the magical women from the sirens. So yeah.
Interesting. And just finally, I like to ask every author this. What surprised you most as you worked on the research for this book and the writing of it?
I think the sales was one thing. And then I was really surprised by the variation in burials, for example, and just how interesting burials can be, and the kind of extremely wide range of goods that people were putting in their loved ones' graves. And I think the most astonishing burial of all time is the Oseberg ship, which is the resting place, or was the resting place, of two women. And one of them was quite old. She was at least over 70, which like for that time was really, really old, because people just had much shorter lives. and the other one was a little bit younger. And they were buried with, you know, just an amazing amount of really lovely stuff.
like what?
Yeah. So they had like a, I think they were, they had a tent and a sleigh and a wagon, and they had a complete set of, you know, everything you needed to cook. And so that involved, you know, like cooking implements and pots and a roasting spit and all kinds of things. And yeah, and they had all kinds of carved, beautiful objects and yeah, gosh, I can't remember everything.
Well. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, everything was beautiful.
Where was that?
So this was found a little bit south of Oslo, and the burial was from the sort of fairly early in the 9th century. And there was this tapestry in the burial as well that's just, you know, extremely fascinating because, I mean, it was obviously damaged from having been in the earth from, you know, the 9th century, but it, we can still like discern that there were figures on it, and they seem to be in some kind of like parade or procession. And they are sometimes some of them are holding spears. Mm. And there are all these trees, and it's just extremely like mysterious what's being represented. And there's a lot of sort of bird-like creatures, and yeah, it's just really fascinating. And because there's no labels, you know, like with so much of the visual imagery and the sort of iconography from the Viking Age, we don't really know what is being represented and whether it's a myth that we also find recorded, you know, in Snorri's Edda, or whether it's a myth that's been lost, or, you know, what's happening. And so I'm really, really fascinated by all that.
So the quest will continue.
Yes, it will.
For the answer about Viking. And as your quest continues, Johanna, what is next for you? What's your next project?
Yeah, well, I think that I am going to write another book about Viking women.
Excellent.
And it's going to be a little bit different because I'm going to focus on just one month.
Ah.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic. Well, can we invite you back to discuss it when it's published? Good. I'm afraid that is kind of all we have time for today, but this has been a really exciting discussion about Viking women and their age and their hopes and dreams. Mm. Before I let you go, where can listeners find out more about you and your work? You are on Twitter, I know.
I am on Twitter. Saga Knitter on Twitter.
That's right. You have the best Twitter handle of any of my authors. At Saga Knitter.
It was just sort of a joke, and then it kind of just stuck, I guess. But
that's perfect.
I also have vikingwomen.org. Uh-huh. And so there's a lot of stuff on there about me and my projects. And then if you want to buy the book, you can go to bloomsbury.com and just put in Valkyrie and you'll find it.
Great. And it is available wherever great books are sold, I think.
Indeed.
Okay. Well, I wish you the best of luck with it. It's a fascinating book, and I recommend it highly to our listeners. Johanna, thank you so much for this wonderful discussion.
Thank you so much for having me and for all your great questions.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jennifer Yirimeeva. I will be back soon with another interview about a new book and with its author. Thank you so much for listening.